Hey, so as some of you guys might know, I'm a music teacher, and I found that one of the best ways that I can process the whole transition to online learning and teaching is to write a song. So I wrote a song. I'd like to share that with you guys now. Here we go.
Clem and Em podcast with Clemmy Stewart and Emma Kell.
Welcome to another edition of the Clem and Em podcast, and we are delighted to be here after a very smooth technological start, wasn't it, Clem?
When you say smooth, do you mean growth mindset, learning from mistakes, that kind of thing?
Watching my husband try to maintain calm whilst we gradually plug and unplug things and work out which way round the microphone's supposed to go, Clem.
Do you know, as I listened to him, I thought, God, this man would be a good teacher, because I know him well enough now to know there was that hint of, for the love of Jesus, why are you so incompetent? But it didn't come out. It didn't come out. It was just go to the Apple, press the Apple, system preferences, you've got this. And I thought, yeah, this guy belongs in a classroom, actually. I was, yeah. Sorry, Rav.
Which side is the plastic on?
Yeah. Where are the knobs, Clem? Where are the knobs? Well, there's a question. There's a question, especially after this week. So how are we doing, yes, my friend? How are you doing?
We're doing all right. I mean, I've just got three words going round and round and round my head, which are another 3 weeks. And I'm not surprised, because in fact I didn't even know there was a possibility of there not being another 3 weeks. But when it was made official in the daily government post show weeks briefing yesterday, it was just a bit like, just sent us all into this completely grumpy spin and had a fight over the last pot noodle, and everyone just got a bit grumpy, you know. What about you?
You know, like you say, there was a real sense of inevitability around it. And I thought, yeah, makes sense. And in a way, actually, it gives us another 3 weeks of certainty. Although it's uncertain, it's 3 weeks of you're definitely off, which from a school perspective really helps, because we can say, right, this is our provision for the next 3 weeks. So it's okay. It's the new norm, isn't it? Be okay with it not being okay.
The new normal. That's got to be on our bingo, Clem. It's got to be on our bingo.
It should be.
And there's loads to be hopeful about. And there are loads of amazing people out there doing amazing things. Teachers using their science labs, or whatever you use, technology labs, to make 4D visors.
Now we've had this chat. 3D.
what would a 4D visor have? Some kind of zapping
maybe technology? Maybe the vaccine as well. I don't know. Yeah. But you're absolutely right. In fact, shout out to Pam Hutchinson from my school, is a DT teacher. She has been sewing scrubs for weeks. I'm so proud of her. My girls have been making bags for scrubs to go into.
Everyone.
Yeah, it's so cute. And they've been painting these really lovely messages on. And Kingston Police retweeted one going, oh, look at these amazing bags. I was like, oh, it's from my girls. There's a real sense of people pitching in and helping out. I suppose the slightly negative side of me thinks, why should they have to do this? Surely we should have enough scrubs and enough visors and enough goggles. It's good that we're all stepping up and helping, but really, is that all we've got?
Interestingly, I've just been out delivering soup. I feel like a complete fraud, because I didn't make it. So I drove to the car park.
Shh, don't tell them.
I drove to the car park. And these two lovely ladies, one handed over this freshly made soup from the professional kitchen, and another one handed over these beautiful, freshly baked loaves of bread. And then I got to go around and give them to people. So I said, nice. Oh, I didn't make them. Yeah, the least well-earned accolade I've ever had. But it was a lovely, lovely thing to do. But there were a couple of people a bit offended, and you just can't please everyone. It's like, well, I don't like parsnip. No one actually said they didn't like parsnip, but it's that kind of thing, isn't it? Where people feel a bit sensitive.
It's the spectrum. I think that there's a spectrum of normality, and then there's a spectrum we're on now. And I've certainly seen it in myself. Things that normally would just be a bit of a grievance or a bit of a sadness have been the end of the world. Yet things that I always tell my girls to not do, i.e. blow things out of proportion, actually I have been significantly blowing out of proportion. And I think everybody's in that situation. Everything's just magnified.
People are flouncing on and off Twitter, left, right and centre. It's like, I'm leaving.
I'm leaving. And then no one responds. We'd get one like. You think, oh, love you. Try again. Like, give it an hour and try again.
I'm leaving. I just checked in on my laptop just to make sure I'd shut down all my preferences.
It's just brilliant. And likewise on emails, when you're getting that kind of passag tone to emails, and we had the best thing yesterday, and neither of them will mind me mentioning it, but like a shout out, if I may, to my SLT, who have been absolutely phenomenal and have not had a day off or holiday, just working on online provision and inset and how we can do inset online and all of this stuff. And then last night, Alistair, who's one of my deputy heads, wrote this brilliant guide sort of, you know, zooming our inset and teamsing this and drop-ins that. And then Byron, my other deputy head, replied. He thought he was just replying to Alistair. He actually replied all going, mate, this is awesome. I'm so excited. What an amazing online provision. Kiss. And then I then had to Instagram Alistair and go, mate, he does know he's hit reply all. I then told him, he replied going, oh my God, this is so awkward. And I just thought, you know what? You guys are running online provision for Monday, but don't worry about it. We've got this. It's just so nice.
Completely under control.
Yeah, thank God all he did was put a kiss at the end of it. Imagine what else he could have put. I mean, it's just brilliant. God. This is just the new norm.
Oh, you just reminded me about accidentally sending an email about someone to them.
Oh. Oh, God, it's the worst.
I still feel awful about this. It was done, like everything at the moment, out of love, but I was really quite concerned about the well-being of a teacher. So yeah. I outlined all the reasons why I was concerned to send to my line manager.
Oh, my God.
Sent it to the teacher. You know, when you're just running along the corridor as if somehow you're going to beat this email.
Yes. And what are you going to do?
I'm so sorry. I've just sent this and I was just about to have the conversation with you, yeah. Honestly.
I think it's all you can do. It's all you can do. Another colleague of mine the other day had quite a complex email and thought they had forwarded it on, but instead of just replied to the parent, said, call me. So, no, dear sir, or thank you, sir, just call me. It just makes you sound direct. It's fine. You know, we're all working against the timeline at the moment. But it is a nightmare. It is a nightmare. You have to be so careful.
But on being careful, I've been asking around Twitter on people feeling judged and judginess. But there have been a few things that have come out where I thought, oh, I've done that. Like telling people how young they look. And you can't possibly be old enough to have grandchildren. And actually, people can take those things a bit personally. And someone just sent me the one about assuming someone's pregnant.
I've had that so many times. Last few years, I have had that so many times. As a woman in her, well, I'd perhaps say early 30s, now mid 30s, who is married without children, the amount of times, like if I don't drink at an event, they're like,
something you're not telling us.
Yeah, just not drinking. Or even things driving. Like, well, you know, next couple of years, you'll be on maternity leave. I'm like, well, that would involve me actually getting pregnant. So it's just the weirdest thing. And people are so quick to observe whether you should be or shouldn't be. In fact, a really good friend of mine, Jenny Harkin, wanted to do a talk about this, about that sort of the awkward question that you would never normally ask. And yet when you're a woman between, I don't know, 25 and 35, suddenly it's all bets are off. You can ask anything you want. Why have you got children? Why have you not got children? Why are you doing this? Why are you not doing that?
There is something about pregnancy and childbirth which gives everyone the right to an opinion. I had a friend who was shouted at on the tube for drinking a can of Coke whilst pregnant. Another friend who, a colleague actually, who was in very early stages of pregnancy, and she'd told a few of us just because we needed to know on health and safety grounds. And someone had got wind of it in the staff room and decided it was her right to know. So she walked up to this woman, touched her stomach and said, so when were you going to tell us all? Oh, and by the way, it's definitely a girl.
And my
colleague was really, who is the most unfazed person ever, was totally devastated. This invasion of her privacy.
It is extraordinary, but these are all just human observations. It's people just looking and sensing and wondering and then just saying. And I find it extraordinary what people say. And I suppose it links beautifully to the fantastic guests we've got on today, because that is their job. It is their job to observe and comment, although I'm sure all three are far too gentlemanly to ever comment on whether a woman might be pregnant or not. And on that note, thank God this is remote and they're not looking at me, because since marathon training has been postponed, I have grown quite beautifully. And it's definitely not baby related.
Is it all cake, Clem?
Yeah, a bit of cake, a lot of Easter eggs. Our key worker parents have been sending in Easter eggs and Prosecco at great speed, which is very kind and very well received, too well received. I dine on mini eggs, but it's okay. I can live with that. Is that I've got new, it in perspective.
The new dinner, replace yeah. Pringles as dinner.
Yeah. Yeah, my COVID diet is a little bit of dairy milk, a little bit of little mini egg. Yeah, it's fine. It's all good. No one can see me.
So do you want to introduce our first guest, Clem?
Absolutely. So I have the absolute pleasure of introducing Hadley Stewart. Now, as far as I'm aware, Hadley Stewart is a different Stewart to Clemmy Stewart, but there may well be a link there somewhere. Hadley is a journalist and very passionate about observing human nature and maintaining people's rights. And I've also noticed from his Twitter handle, he contributed to one of my favourite books in the last year, which is Boys Don't Try. With the question mark at the end, it's worth pointing out, Boys Don't Try. And so I'm really excited that he's joining us. So very warm welcome to you, Hadley.
Oh, thank you so much for that lovely introduction.
My pleasure. We need to touch base after this about whether we are related or not.
Do you know, I come across so many people called Stuart. It's I'm sure we are somewhere.
We're quite common, aren't we?
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah, there's nothing rare about that last name, is there?
However, Benjamin Butterworth has to be about the coolest name I've ever heard in my life.
I quite like such my name, but it often gets mistaken for Benjamin Button, I'm afraid.
Oh, that's brilliant. I love it. Well, Benjamin was born the year I started university.
That's such a good fact.
Just like, how can you be so young and so accomplished?
I'm judging
honestly.
You. I'm judging you.
Honestly, I've been reading up around you, Benjamin, and you're so impressive. You're a journalist for iNews, so you're doing the daily news roundups, which must be a challenge at the moment. Written extensively about LGBT issues. You're former chair of Young Labour. Mm-hmm. You famously had a proper on-screen row with Piers Morgan.
Yes, I've had a couple of them. And it's quite an intense experience. But you know what? It's always nice to get to put your point across and to get to sort of, when you believe in something, the chance to say it on television or on a podcast or anything is always really valuable, even if Piers Morgan is shouting back at you that you're completely wrong. He's one of those people that respects someone that gives as good as they get and stands up for their point of view. And so, you know, it's in a way, he's quite a good person to argue against because it's like a really intense tennis match.
I love
yes.
that.
So Hadley, how is lockdown treating you?
It's treated me all right, actually. I was meant to be in New York this week, which unfortunately hasn't happened. Put on hold, but for very good reason, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. And how about you, Benjamin?
I'm finding it a bit difficult. You know, we knew that this second three-week period was going to come, and we understand the reasons why. They've been explained about, you know, flattening the peak and the rest of it, which is important. But it's difficult because I don't have outside green space, and I'm dating someone who I don't live with. And so, you know, I'm now 4 weeks into getting up every morning, having no one in person to talk to, you know, only being able to see my significant other through WhatsApp messages and phone calls. And so, you know, it is quite difficult. And it's a bit frustrating when some people say, oh, you know, you're not out fighting wars. Well, no. And I have an increased respect for people who did that because there's some minor insight into what it's like to be separated from loved ones at the moment. But it's still difficult. And it's so sudden, you know, it happened so quickly that it is quite hard to deal with. And I'm just trying to focus on, you know, 3 weeks from now when some of this should be lifted.
I think you're right there. I think that the speed at which it all happened was quite shocking. And then to not have an end point, you know, I used to work in a school with lots of army children and we used to say, you know, your dad will be home in 6 months or 5 months, whatever it was. And as hard as it is, at least you have an end point. Whereas I think the difficulty with this is not having an end point and not being able to work towards an exact date or time is really hard. It's hard for the children, but I think it's just as hard for us adults too.
It must be really hard for kids, especially, I suppose, primary school ones and maybe, you know, ones that are in a position where they don't entirely understand what's going on in the world or they really rely on that routine normally. It must be very stressful for them.
It is. I think it really is. And I think that routine they absolutely love and they do want to come back to school. They really do. And I think just not knowing when they find so hard. I mean, they kind of split things up between Christmas, Easter, you know, the big dates they understand. And you can't really put this one anywhere on a calendar yet. And that's hard.
You are both professional observers of human nature. So what kind of bizarre human behaviour have you noticed during this period?
Something I've observed, and I'm writing a story about this, is sleep, how sleep has got much worse. People are having far more vivid dreams. They're sleeping more irregularly. They're finding it harder and they're having stronger dreams. And I have to say, I've experienced that. And I think that that can really mess people's days and weeks up.
A lot of people are working from home. Obviously, they're not used to working from home. Making sure that you're not working on your bed or in your bedroom, trying to use a different room. But it can be quite difficult if you're living in a small flat or in a studio, if you've got lots of different people in the house at the same time. And then also, of course, we're not waking up at the same time as we were before. For some people, there won't be that pressure to necessarily be at the office for a certain time. So I think just having that routine is really healthy. And perhaps with this lockdown, just let it slip a little bit, just because we're at home and we think that we don't need a routine, but perhaps we actually do.
I know a lot of people that I'm working with are really struggling with sleeping and waking up in the middle of the night and then stressing out about stuff. And I think that's really hard. And I've noticed with our key worker children, they are absolutely shattered. And they're starting term again on Monday. They look like they've had a full term. They look exhausted already. And I think sleep's something we do need some help with.
It's things like being able to go out to a cafe or to pick up the newspaper and stuff like that, which I really miss, because maybe I didn't always do it at the same time, but it was such an important part of my work-life balance. You know, I would always, on a Saturday, I would go to have brunch somewhere nice, whether it was alone or with a friend, and I would read the paper and chat, and I'd spend several hours, and it would be really calm and I wouldn't look at my phone. And that was a really important part of my routine for letting off steam and relaxing. And I know, as someone who writes newspapers, it might be a bit of a busman's holiday to read them for a weekend activity. Losing that sense of balance in your work life is one of the harder things, I think.
Definitely. There are definitely blurred lines now, I think, between work and home. I've certainly found that over the last few weeks. I jokingly said to my husband tonight, oh, tonight's the last night of my holidays, when, you know, I've been working every single day since we theoretically broke up. And I think we have to be, and when I say we, I mean the collective, we have got to be better at switching off and saying, actually, for the next few hours or the next afternoon, I'm not working. I may be at home, it may be a working day, but I'm not working this afternoon, because you do need that break in your brain and in your mind and in your activities, so that there is that break between home and work. Otherwise, we're all going to go potty, I think.
I'm not having that outside contact. I'm not having the change of environment. So I think, yeah, productivity is down a little bit. But yeah, I think it's just adapting now. We've been in it 3 weeks, so...
The only other thing I pick up on from what Benjamin was saying earlier is the dating scene. And the reason why I ask is there's a brilliant guy on Twitter called Tom Rogers who has set up EduDate, which is this dating for single people on Twitter at the moment in the education world. And the only reason I know about it is because one of my colleagues, who I won't name, had a very successful series of dates through EduDate and has come to work in the most wonderful of moods today.
I mean, some of these online meeting things have had a bit of controversy recently, though, haven't they, with Zoom, with unexpected members turning up.
I heard about that.
This was an edu-meet. I tragically missed the uninvited visitor, or visitors, I think. There were a couple of them. I think the EduDate is wonderful, and I salute them. I just worry a little bit about if I were a bored teenager at home stalking my teachers online. I just worry a tiny, tiny bit. I know my daughter does stalk her teachers. She regards them with absolute disdain, but she does online stalk them on a fairly regular basis. So just a note of caution there.
So on to notes of caution, we do actually have another person on our pod this week. And I feel really responsible for this because I, as you were saying earlier, trying to maintain a sense of normality, I popped out last Saturday and picked up the Times and a nice coffee somewhere and came back and sat down and read what was one of the funniest pieces I've read in ages, which was sort of a week in the life of somebody in isolation, written by Hugo Rifkind. And I was howling with laughter because every single sentence reminded me of something I had seen or heard in the last few weeks, including, and I can only say this because my mother doesn't ever listen to podcasts, she's still living off her Brexit stockpile. So thankfully, it just chimed with me on every possible level. And we cheekily said, oh my God, can you imagine if we got Hugo Rifkind on our podcast?
And
that would just be amazing.
Internet stalked him.
We stalked him just like your children. And we got him. So Hugo, we are so delighted to have you. Thank you so much for coming to join us. Tell us a little bit about the piece for those who didn't read it.
Basically, I write this sort of this parody diary thing in the Times called My Week, where I try and, you know, sort of write about a different figure every week. And I couldn't think of anyone to do last week because normally it's a business of kind of, you know, sort of taking the piss out of politicians. And it didn't feel quite right taking the piss out of politicians last week because they're trying really hard and all the jokes are about death and horrible things. I've managed again this week, so let's not go overboard on that. But still, I sort of thought I can't do Trump again, and all the jokes are just too grisly. And then I thought, well, actually, we're all behaving in a slightly, you know, because a column like that, why it works is what you're looking for is hypocrisy. And I thought, actually, we're all hypocrites at the moment. We all go to the park and are furious that everyone else is in the park, even though we're in the park. You know, we're all kind of like, we're all going, why the hell can't I get any flour to bake the sourdough that I started, like, developed a passion for 4 days ago? You know, and we're all kind of living like that a bit. And I thought, well, maybe I'll try and sort of turn it inwards. I mean, what was slightly uncomfortable about it is some people thought that what I was actually doing was kind of talking about the ludicrousness of lockdown. I don't think lockdown is ludicrous at all. I'm so glad we're stuck in houses. It's terrifying out there. You know, actually, I think it's, but what I wanted to focus in on was the way that we all think that. We all think it shouldn't quite apply to us.
You hit the nail on the head with all of the little sort of nuances and twists of what you were saying. And I thought if you'd been writing it this week, would you be commenting on the fact that after the NHS clap at 8 o'clock last night, everyone turned on people today to say they were all clapping too closely together?
And yes.
I just thought, here we go again.
Irregular clapping. Well, it's funny what we're developing now is, I mean, because it's so when you write at all, but so particularly when you try and write funny, what you really, really want is shared experience that you can refer to something and everyone knows what you're talking about. And something that, I mean, it's actually very, I mean, I was listening before when you were all talking about what it's like writing at the moment. It's actually incredibly hard to do a lot of writing at the moment because you're not sure what you think and you don't have confidence in what you think and everything just generally is so unsettled. But where we're very fortunate as writers at the moment is what we're doing is we're building a huge amount of shared experience. And for the rest of all of our lives, we'll be able to refer back to now. And when we haven't all had the same experience. Some people have had sort of like dramatically different experiences, and some people are having much better experiences than other people. But there are bits of commonality that are always kind of going to be there in the same way as like a TV program everyone's watched. And the kind of the clapping outside is one of them. It's this sort of incredible communal experience. It's really moving.
I actually get excited by it. I don't know if anybody else does, but I look at my clock at about 7:45 and think, oh, I'm going to see people in 15 minutes. And then we all get out onto our windows and we cheer and we shout. And then there's this horrible feeling of dread as it starts to quieten down. You think, well, that's it for a week.
Oh, that's it.
Yeah. And then you sort of like sadly pull your window down and turn back to your sourdough, as you were saying. It's quite sad.
It's amazing how we're in lockdown and my children still find me embarrassing. So we just get the loudest possible pots and pans from the drawers and then we howl and sing outside while my 12-year-old sort of skulks behind the hedge going, oh, Mom, stop it.
It's so embarrassing.
We have bongo drums and a howling dog, which kind of really helps.
The dog
does join in. Yeah.
This is like a clap off. I'm going to have to get my dad to get the donkeys out next Thursday and see if he can get them braying.
As long as they can socially distance.
exactly. But no, it is amazing. It's so British, I think. It's so British.
It's deciding what tone to actually strike, isn't it? That's really hard without coming across as mocking or judgy or smug or worthy or I don't know.
I'm a very unplanned sort of, I mean, I'd have some colleagues who I speak to or like peers who I speak to who like they've got like the next 15 ideas lined up and they've got more ideas than they can ever write. I have fewer ideas than I can write. You know, I never really know what I'm writing about until an hour beforehand when I really need to tell somebody so they know what to put in the newspaper. And so it's so the question of how I figure out what to write about next is kind of just sort of in a blind panic trying to find anything really. I mean, it's that column in particular, the funny Saturday column. I won't lie, it's really hard at the moment. It's really hard to find the kind of humor in this situation. I write a more serious kind of opinion column in the paper, and that's quite a lot easier because we're all having big profound thoughts at the moment. But actually finding the bit that you can laugh at, the bit that you kind of think it's okay to mock that, it's no breeze at the moment. I mean, you know, people are doing harder jobs. Let's be honest. But in the many years I've been doing that column, I think now's definitely the hardest time to do it.
What's this is a question for all three of you as journalists and media. What I noticed, I saw some data released the other day that confidence in politicians has gone up, confidence in local government has gone up, confidence in media and journalism has gone down quite significantly. What's your thinking around that, and how does that feel as somebody who is a journalist?
I think that's kind of right and almost deserved, in that I don't have a huge amount of confidence in politicians. Something I quite appreciate at the moment is the fact that Germany's doing everything first. So basically Angela Merkel's in charge, and that's fine by me. Better than Boris Johnson. I'm all right with that. But generally speaking, I think almost what I was talking about, the difficulty of knowing what to mock at the moment, is I write editorials in the Times, so we have a decent amount of briefing and a decent amount of real information floating around. But I can't pretend that I know more about what's going on than Matt Hancock does. And so the process of critiquing people who are trying to solve this problem is kind of, you know, you do feel a strong sense of imposter syndrome. You do look closely at yourself and go, what right do I have to do this? And if the public's picking up on that a bit as well, I mean, fair enough, really. Which is, I don't see that as a defense of politicians, that they're necessarily doing the right thing and doing well. I'm sure in many, many cases they're definitely not. But there is something slightly artificial about not the scrutiny that journalists are doing, because that's obviously really important, but the point where you get an opinion columnist suggesting they know better about what to do. Mm. It's like, no, you don't.
I was going to say, you know, I agree with Hugo. I was doing the breakfast show on Talk Radio the other day, and at the end of some comments about Chris Whitty and Matt Hancock and the rest of them, I said, not that any of us know the answers. And somehow that comment kind of echoed through the next 3 hours, because I thought, do you know what, here I am sort of filling all these hours and writing all these things and actually really, really don't know the answers, because it takes proper experts that dedicated their lives to this. And also, you know, there's the thing about Piers Morgan asked Matt Hancock if he'd take a pay cut like footballers had. And I that was one of the things that prompted me to say, well, actually, I'm going to defend politicians on this case, because my God, can you imagine being the health secretary in a global pandemic? It doesn't feel, you know, there's plenty of things to question, but work ethic and decency as a human being, I can't help but respect at this time, which is so different to normal. I have to say, I'm surprised that people's trust in the media is lower right now, because people's consumption of mainstream media is higher than it has been for, you know, at least a decade. BBC News Channel has been getting more people watching it than were watching Channel 4 the other evening. You know, it's maybe that says more about Channel 4, but it's through the roof. You know, the figures for BBC News at 6 have put millions on. And so I find it odd that people would be less trusting of the media, because they're consuming it far more.
I think there's a thing that when people talk about the media, they don't really mean the media. It's like that whole thing about people who go, look, I saw this story, it's a story on the BBC, why is nobody covering it? And it's like, well, they are covering it, that's why you saw it on the BBC.
It's on the BBC,
you
know, so yeah.
When people talk about the media, they talk about not trusting the media, they actually generally mean a very, very small part of the media that they find completely unacceptable.
Do you think there's something that could be done with the whole sort of daily briefing? Because I always get that sense watching it that, you know, whichever poor member of the cabinet has been put in front of everyone to tell us what's going on has that tricky task. And then you've got those two brilliant experts either side of them that just give such a sense of calm and knowledge and purpose. And then you have these series of questions, and some of them are so fantastic, and you think, God, that's exactly what I was wondering. Others, you just think, why are you asking that? Or he's just answered that. And then they get this chance to come back again. And what are your reflections on that, and how that could maybe be improved?
The best suggestion I've heard is that they should have science journalists in there rather than lobby correspondents. A lot of this is a political story as well as being a science story. You know, there are political decisions as well as scientific ones about when we leave lockdown and all that kind of stuff. But I think there's a slight temptation, you know, the political reporting is, and I say this with absolute respect and indeed love for many of my friends and colleagues who are political reporters, but political reporting is melodramatic and hysterical. And because it's all about taking sometimes a relatively small story and turning up to 11. And so, I mean, you can see it when you get a political reporter covering a story of massive import, say a terrorist attack or something, they cover it in a completely different way to a crime reporter, because they're looking for the thing to shout about. They're looking for somebody to criticize. It's the nature of political reporting. And so what that means is that at the moment, the interrogation of politicians is more adversarial than it necessarily ought to be, but they don't really know how to question scientists, because they don't know how to critique scientists, they don't know how to disagree with scientists. So the scientists are sort of given this sort of godlike pass. And I reckon there are a lot of brilliant science journalists in Britain. If you got some of them there instead, asking all the questions instead, then it would just be a completely different tone. I mean, maybe, God knows, you know, maybe we'd all watch it for a day and go, I didn't understand a word of that. Let's get back to the politicians. But it's it feels like that might be a sensible move.
We've been reading all over the internet about people learning conversational Russian and origami and all sorts of different things. I've learned that I still can't cook, but I have started planting things, and I have to go and check on my cauliflower sprouts about 15 times a day to see if they've grown another millimetre. I don't even know whether they grow upwards or downwards yet, but I'll let you know. So what other skills have you learned, or what have you learned about yourselves, or what skills have you learned during this time?
So I've not learned to knit or anything like that, but I think what I've learned about myself is sort of finding ways to switch off, because we're being bombarded constantly by the news, and yes, we all want to find out what's going on, but then I think that can be all very overwhelming if you just sat in front of the news all day, or consuming it in however way you want to consume it. So I think, yeah, just being quite disciplined, taking an hour to myself and maybe going off to read a book or go for a walk. And, you know, I think that's something that I wasn't doing before the lockdown. And I just think I wasn't really giving myself proper boundaries. I mean, it sounds a bit airy-fairy, but sort of giving yourself kind of boundaries in your working day and just taking some time to yourself. And it's, I think it's really improved my mental health, really, to be honest.
I've learned that it's probably not the world conspiring against me, or the tube or the traffic that makes me late for meetings or for work and things. It probably is just me, considering that all I have to do is walk from the living room to the desk and still manage to start 10 minutes late to everything. So that's been sort of something of a home truth. I've also taken up cycling. Now, I've lived in London for 9 years, and I never dared cycle because I was scared of getting, you know, hit by a car or something, because it's so busy. I was anxious of it. But one of the great advantages of lockdown is that the roads are so empty and we're allowed this daily exercise. And, you know, a bit like Hugo's piece in The Times, when you're jogging, it's kind of, you know, you can't help but get near other people and get grumpy at them for it. But cycling is a great socially distanced exercise to do. And it's a way to sort of get a bit further than I ever could jogging. So I've taken that up and I hadn't cycled for a long time. The last time I cycled was I cycled around Albania last September. And the reason I did that was because it was the easiest way to get out of Albania, was to get a bike. But actually, it's been great to return to it in London. And actually, you know, I suspect this is true of lots of other parts of the country. The roads are empty, so it's a much safer time to try and do something like cycling. So I'd really recommend that as something that it's actually an opportunity to do at the moment.
I'm learning nothing. I mean, I mean, I was talking to someone the other day about the kind of the extreme differences in people's experience of lockdown. The difference between somebody who's, for example, got no work, worried about money, alone in a flat without a garden, and then somebody like me. I'm still in full-time employment. I'm working every day. My wife is also in full-time employment, but we have two kids, 8 and 11, are in the house with us. I'm crazy. I'm just every moment I have is spent running around, you know, either childcare or the day job. So the idea that I'm also going to learn Russian or Serbo-Croat, I mean, come on.
You're doing the homeschooling whilst writing then. I'm finding my average length of uninterrupted time is about 140 seconds before someone comes in and says, who are you talking to?
We're kind of sharing it. The best, I mean, the kids demanded a holiday for the holidays, which is like, well, no, what are you going to do now then? But the best tip for homeschooling was somebody told me, put on a David Attenborough documentary and get them to write down 10 things they've learned by the end of it. Brilliant. That's an hour saved.
That's,
you know,
genius.
I can write a paragraph. Yeah. So no, I'm learning nothing. I'm not self-improving in any way.
Do you know, I think there's a whole series of people cheering you right now, Hugo. I think you've just buoyed an entire generation of people who don't want to learn anything new in the next 3 weeks. Well done.
Not even reading books.
Superb.
I love it. Maybe it's time for me to finally learn how to ride a bike.
You ride horses.
Yeah, horses are far
That's
more
That's much
stable.
Harder. No, they're not.
Yeah, I just made a really good pun. I've learned I'm very funny. No, they just, all four legs generally keep them upright, whereas bikes just fall over. I just can't do it.
Bikes don't have any legs, it's true.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I can't have stabilisers at the ripe old age of 35. Every year, year six, try and get me to do bikeability with them, and every year I say no because I've got an injury, and it's a lie. It's a lie. If any of them hear this, it's a lie. I just can't ride a bike.
Did you not learn as a child? Was there not a time when your parents tried to sort of say, come on, you know, ride a bike?
I just don't think they love me enough. It literally just didn't happen. They shoved me on a pony, smacked it on the backside, and that was it.
My dad learned to ride a bike at 35.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, although I don't think he's ridden a bike since he was 35, but still, he did learn at 35. I remember it happening, yeah.
Well, so if we get another announcement in another 3 weeks' time that we're staying in lockdown, I will learn to ride a bike. There we go, I will do that.
She said it here first.
We're going to hold you to that.
Yeah, great. You have to come and help me. You have to push me.
So she can't cook, she can't ride a bike. Anything else? Anyone else can't do things? I've never been to a pop concert.
That's what?
No, never. My parents wouldn't let me. They were very strict. They obviously didn't love me enough either, Clem. I wasn't allowed to go. We lived near Wembley and I was never allowed to go. And then by the time I was allowed to go, I was so old that I didn't really care anymore.
Yeah. I took my dad to the Blue on tour, the Guilty tour. I took my dad, Alistair Stewart, went to a Blue concert at Wembley.
Wow.
How did he find that?
He sat and clapped along in chinos and a shirt. Brilliant. And the poor man, I mean, he's obsessed with the Rolling Stones and Pink Floyd. He's actually quite cool. So it must have been awful, awful for him.
That's
but I loved every
minute.
That's
got to hurt, yeah.
But now I tell you, even worse than that was we then, do you remember when ITV used to do an audience with, and they did an audience with Take That. We went up to the bar afterwards and Gary Barlow was buying a drink and I was sort of fangirling all over the place and Dad introduced me and he went, oh, hello, nice to meet you. And Dad went, oh my God, you sound just like Wallace and Gromit. I literally wanted the ground to eat me up. And he was like, oh, thank you very much. I was like, oh my God, this is horrendous. So yeah, we've never done anything like that since.
It's
dreadful.
All coming out now.
Oh dear. Well, there you go.
Well, that's been another seamless edition of the Clem and Em podcast. We would love to hear from you. What can't you do? So Clemmy has revealed that she can't ride a bike. We know she can't cook and nor can I. So do share with us your various incompetences or gaps in your knowledge on Twitter at Clem and Em, hashtag Clem and Em podcast.
And do also share any reflections you've had. We've had three amazing guests on this evening. So Benjamin, Hadley and Hugo, thank you so, so much for your time, your insights, your reflections. I'm sure you've given our listeners a huge amount to think about. So thank you all so much for your time.
Such a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much.
Until the next time, stay safe and we'll see you soon.
Thank you so much for listening. Take care.
The Clem and Em podcast was presented by Clemmy Stewart and Emma Kell, joined by Hugo Rifkind, Benjamin Butterworth and Hadley Stewart, produced by Rav Vadgama. The Clem and Em podcast is a Those That Can production.